May it please the court, counsel, good afternoon, your honors. My name is Michael Bone with the law firm of Bone Aguilar LLC, and I represent the defendants appellants in this case, CBDG LLC and Timothy Cal. Your honors, defendants in this case respectfully request that this court reverse the trial court's denial of defendants' request for attorney's fees in the trial court's April 19, 2013 order, and remand the case to the trial court, directing the trial court to enter an order awarding defendants all of their reasonable attorney's fees incurred in defending against this lawsuit from the time it was filed until the time it concludes, including specifically any attorney's fees and costs incurred in prosecuting this appeal. We would also recommend that the remand order direct the trial court to consider whether that attorney fee order should be made joint and several against plaintiffs and their counsel based on the arguments that we've advanced in this appeal and in the trial court. The basis for our attorney's fees in this case basically stems from three separate grounds. Two of those grounds are premised upon mandatory fee-shifting provisions contained in contracts that were at issue in the underlying lawsuit. Specifically, there was a lease agreement and there was a settlement agreement.
Were the parties parties to those contracts?
The parties were parties to the settlement agreement that was entered into in February of 2007 that resolved litigation that was filed in 2005.
And that's the one that dealt only with rent, is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's not what's at issue in this case, is it?
It's not at issue in this case.
So only the why does settlement agreement apply?
I just want to make sure I understand your question. Was it why the settlement agreement applies to?
Why does it apply in this case? Since I think case related to rent, and isn't that the scope of the attorney's fees for me?
No, not entirely, Your Honor. The 2005 litigation was commenced by my client, CBDG, under the terms of the same lease that's at issue in this case, and on which the plaintiff sought to enforce the terms of the lease by recovering their security deposit. That 2005 lawsuit that was initially filed based on rents and other matters set forth in the lease, the parties did reach the comprehensive settlement agreement. In that settlement agreement, though, the parties specifically agreed that any and all prior agreements between them, any contracts between them, would be superseded by the comprehensive form of mutual release that the parties entered into in February of 2007. So, 5 months later, CBDG, after it settled that first lawsuit, was sued by the plaintiffs in this case seeking to recover the security deposit, and we advanced in this case a counterclaim based on breach of that settlement agreement, because it is our contention that that broad form of confidential mutual release did cover the very claims that were advanced by plaintiffs in this case. That's why my clients entered into that settlement agreement. And it is our contention that, in fact, we did prevail in this case because we proved that plaintiffs should not have brought this lawsuit to recover the security deposit.
But the settlement agreement doesn't cover security deposits, does it?
Yes, we believe it does. Does it expect
what's the it? What's the language you're relying on?
There's actually two key provisions in that agreement that we've set forth in our brief, and that is, it's Exhibit D at paragraph 4B, and that is for good and sufficient consideration, receipt and sufficiency of what's hereby acknowledged, and I won't read all of it, but basically it's a broad form of release that says the plaintiffs, in this case, well, let me back up. Kikamu Fitness is the entity that was owned by plaintiffs. All right, Kikamu Fitness in that agreement was specifically defined to include the Bartes in their individual capacity. And if you look at Exhibit D at paragraph 4B, it specifically and clearly is intended to cover any and all claims arising under the terms of this lease.
But it doesn't say that. The language is in any way claims in any way associated with the dispute described herein. The dispute described herein is not the dispute because there wasn't dispute at the time over the security deposit. So, I mean, you use the term broad form release, but it's not a broad form release. It's fairly specific language. Isn't that the problem here?
Well, no, I believe that the language is very comprehensive and broad, Your Honor. In fact, if you look at the language under the mutual release, it's very broad in form, and it says that any claims that the parties now has, or hereafter may have, or claim to have, against CBDG, whether known or unknown, in any way associated with the dispute described herein. But I think what really adds to the modification of that paragraph is the merger clause contained in paragraph 12 of that agreement. It says, this agreement constitutes and contains the entire integrated agreement of the parties with respect to the subject matter hereof, and shall supersede any and all prior negotiations, correspondence, understandings, and agreements between the parties respecting the subject matter hereof.
But counsel, paragraph 3 of the settlement agreement defines the dispute. It says, quote, a dispute arose over the amount of minimum rent and additional rent due to CBDG pursuant to the commercial lease, end quote. So it defines dispute in a particular way. Why isn't that definition applicable to the paragraph of the release you're relying on?
Because I believe that is just, it's my contention that that's just an explanatory statement indicating why the parties are entering into this agreement. But if you look at all of the other language in the agreement.
What's the purpose of it? Why do you set out what the dispute is if you're going to ignore that in the rest of the agreement?
Honestly, Your Honor, I can't speak to that. I didn't draft the agreement, obviously. I'm not trying to evade your question.
Yeah, I understand, but don't we have to go with the plain language? I agree we can't get in the minds of people other than to look at the language they wrote. And here they went to the lengths of defining the dispute, and then use that term in the release. How does the plain language allow us to depart from that definition?
Because again, it is the way that I read this lease, and the way I believe the lease can be read by Your Honors, is that, and the way it should have been read by the trial court based on my arguments, is that it was intended to put to rest any and all dispute between the parties arising from this leasehold interest.
So your position then is that either party, after the settlement, could have breached the release with impunity. That's what you're saying, because the security deposit wasn't due yet. There wasn't a breach of that yet. But your position seems to be, because that's something that could have happened afterwards, that's within the release language.
Absolutely.
Well, if that's the case, then the parties could breach the lease with impunity after the settlement. Either party.
I guess I'm missing that question, Your Honor. I don't believe that's the case, because that's our argument. We believe that this was all put to bed as a result of the settlement agreement. And lo and behold, several months later, my clients are sued again under this leasehold relationship, when in fact it was the intention to put any and all matters arising out of this lease and any prior agreements to bed.
But there wasn't a dispute at that point over the security deposit. It wasn't even due yet.
But it could have been raised in the prior.
How could it have been raised? There was no legal obligation to turn it over yet. There couldn't have been a claim. It wasn't due until months later.
Right, and that's why we're taking the position that if you look at the broad form of language, it's any and all disputes that might arise in the future concerning this leasehold relationship.
And that's my point. So your position essentially is, we're settling any future breaches of the lease.
Absolutely.
Okay, so in other words, any party could breach the lease 2 months after this agreement and there'd be no liability, because that's been settled. That's your argument.
Mr. Bowman, I want to make sure you're going to address the frivolous and groundless litigation statute before your time runs out.
Yes, and Your Honor, actually I'll do that right now because I think this is a good segue. And I think it's important to point this out because we also moved for attorney's fees at the conclusion of trial under the terms of the settlement agreement. The trial court really didn't address that issue other than to say the court, in a separate order dated April 20th, 2011, found that the settlement agreement did not extinguish plaintiff's interest in the security deposit. Well, that can't be, because that's an inconsistent finding by the court, because the court, in the very next paragraph, said that plaintiffs had already assigned any right, title, and interest in this lease back in 2004. So if they assigned any right and title and interest in the lease in 2004, under the terms of the settlement agreement, arguably, it wouldn't address the security deposit because the lease had already been assigned. So any, and I know that sounds somewhat inconsistent, but given the question that was asked about the security agreement and the breadth of the security agreement, I believe that, it's my contention, I'm not backing off of that, that I think it was intended to cover any and all disputes between the parties. But actually, based on this court's ruling in the April 2013 order, the court said that it was relying on its previous decision that said the plaintiffs, that the settlement agreement did not extinguish plaintiffs' interest in the security deposit. Well, that can't be. That can't be consistent with the court's decision, in which it said the court found that any rights under the lease had been transferred to a different tenant back in 2004.
So is that the basis of your claim that it was frivolous and groundless?
Well, there's a variety of bases why it's frivolous and groundless. First of all, plaintiffs in their individual capacity had no rights under this lease in their individual
capacity. Did you raise this argument or this position to the district court?
Absolutely, I did.
Where?
I believe in my motion for attorney's fees, Your Honor. And I also raised, now specifically to be clear, Your Honor, when I filed my answer in the case, which, and there's some question out there in amongst the case law in terms of whether you can actually pursue a counterclaim under the frivolous and groundless statute. But I did in this case, and it wasn't challenged. And in that claim, I specifically made reference that this lawsuit should have been filed for a variety of reasons. And
did you say that in your motion? Did you refer to the counterclaim?
I can't recall if I said that or not.
No, because you don't expect the trial court to go back and read all the pleadings to see if there's something you might have said that might be helpful to your case, do you? Isn't that the idea why we have arguments and we file motions so we can tell, here are the reasons why I believe I'm entitled to attorney's fees?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd agree with that. Okay. And
what are the other reasons that you contend that it was frivolous and groundless?
Well, as I just said, first of all, plaintiffs had no rights in their individual capacity to bring this lawsuit. Second of all, the assignment that was executed by Kikamu Fitness back in 2004, whereby it assigned the leasehold interest, or it assigned its rights in the lease, it didn't retain any rights of the security deposit. So nobody, even Kikamu Fitness, the actual contracting party, had no rights under the terms of the lease once it was assigned. Okay? And so the plaintiffs in their individual capacity certainly couldn't have had any more rights than the primary contracting party that assigned away its rights in 2004. And then third of all, they signed a settlement agreement in which, again, our contention premised upon a comprehensive reading of the settlement agreement. We believe that this lawsuit should not have been filed. And we maintain that position that this lawsuit was frivolous and groundless from the get-go. One more point here. Under that, and I want to reserve a little bit of time here. You recall that one of the arguments that I made in this case is that plaintiffs, from the very beginning, claimed to have rights in the suit because they were assignees from Kikamu Fitness. At no time during the case, even though I alerted them to that 5 years before we got to trial, more than 5 years, they didn't have standing to bring the claims, and they had no proper assignment. And at trial, they offered no evidence in support of any argument that they were assignees under the terms of the agreement. I'd like to reserve basically 55 seconds, unless Your Honors have another question.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Frederick L. Ginsburg, Registration 1029, on behalf of the appellees. Quite frankly, we have stated our position in our papers, and I'm not going to go over all of that. What I am going to say is the court gets it. I just heard the court get it, and that is this. In fact, the settlement agreement the trial court found had no applicability. The settlement agreement applied to the case that it covered. It was a case brought by the landlord against the tenant saying, this was owed, this was owed. And it had nothing to do with this. It, as has already been pointed out, couldn't contemplate the issue of a security deposit being returned or not being returned because it wasn't ripe, if you will. And the time hadn't run, so to speak. The other point is that in this particular case, the court, Tucker, did not find that the plaintiff acted without basis. The cop or simply said, look, you didn't have a good assignment here. In other words, you didn't understand. That was the finding. You know, it's the business of ring. You win some, you lose some. I lost that one.
Yeah, you lost that one, but sir, you specifically alleged in your complaint that the plaintiffs were the assignees, and then as I understand the record, there was absolutely no evidence offered, much less admitted at trial, to prove that. So it seems to me it's a little more than you win some and you lose some.
I will respond. My client testified that it paid the security deposit. That was the whole problem in this case. The security deposit, the testimony from Mr. Barkey was that he personally paid the security deposit rather than the corporation. That's what got this thing going in the first place. Corporation never paid. Essentially, the Barkeys paid the security deposit. So when you talk about an assignment in that, or I mean the evidence in that sense, the security deposit never really belonged to the corporation because it didn't pay it. He paid it. It was his money, so he put it out, if you will.
Counsel, does that mean that if he had put the security deposit on his American Express, if the corporation had an American Express card and he charged on the American Express card, an American Express would have standing and would have the ability to enter to
no.
seek it? What's
no.
the difference?
The difference is the American Express card, as you presented it to me, belonged to the company, belonged to the corporation.
Yeah, but they didn't, but the money was extended by American Express.
Well, yes, but they had to pay back American Express.
Well, I assume that, I don't know, did Kickapoo have to pay back the Parties? Who cares? What difference does it make? The money was paid
by American Express.
But who was it paid on behalf of?
Was the corp, the way you presented it to me.
No, I'm asking you.
Oh.
Who did the Barkeys pay the money on behalf of?
Well, the Barkeys put the money up for the corporation. That's
okay.
what it did. That's what they
okay.
did.
Thank you.
There you go. Yes.
But that's not what you allege in your complaint. I mean, in the specific paragraph about presumably addressing how it is that the Barkeys individually are bringing this lawsuit, you specifically allege plaintiffs are assignees of Kickapoo Fitness. You don't allege this theory that you just explicated. You allege they're assignees. What evidence was there presented at trial that they were assignees?
The answer to your question is that our clients told us they had been assigned that, and when I put that to them, and we believed them, you know, we had no reason not to, and I asked them for sure at the time, I remember, but they said we were the assignees. I mean, we put up the money, and it was assigned back to us by the company. And at that point, I said, well, is that your testimony? And that was his testimony. That's the testimony, and I can only go on what, you know, I was given. And he testified to that. He said, Mr. Barkey said, I put the money up for the company, and that's why I'm here, and that's just what he told me.
Did Mr. Barkey testify at trial that he was the assignee?
I don't believe he did, Judge. I'm going to tell you right now. I do not believe he did. But I can tell you that the court came to the conclusion, trial court, as you've all probably read this, the trial court came to the conclusion and said it doesn't matter because lease doesn't apply. It's gone. And once that happened, then it was all over. The court also said there's no basis for a counterclaim here for attorney's fees. There was never a pleading in the original pleadings. There was never a plea that this case was frivolous or groundless. Later on, in
that,
motion.
Go ahead.
It was never brought up in the pleadings per se, in the answer to the pleadings.
The rules don't require that, do they?
Well,
You know, my understanding is if you want to raise an issue, you got to plead at the start of it.
Doesn't Rule 121, Section 115 specifically state that if you're requesting an award of attorney's fees, you file a post-judgment motion so requested?
Yes, but in your pleadings, at least in my experience, and I, you know, this is just my experience, I'm speaking historically, it has always been my understanding that if you're going to raise an issue with the trial court, you got to do it in either your complaint or your answer or in some pleading in that sense.
Well, how would the defendant know whether or not there had been an assignment until there's discovery?
How would the defendant?
Well, the defendant didn't do any discovery.
I may have the wrong part. How would, I think it's that I'm talking about the defendants because.
He didn't do any discovery.
Okay. But I'm just saying, as a principle, general matter, how does somebody know whether a claim is frivolous, that is lacking in factual support, before they've had an opportunity to do discovery? There may be instances where they do, but obviously there are lots of cases where people wouldn't know.
I would agree with you, but in this particular case, the defendant didn't do any discovery.
But that had nothing to do with whether they're required to file it in their pleading.
Well, I understand that. Again, I'm speaking from getting beat over the head in this game for a number of years. It's always been my understanding if you don't plead it, if you don't raise it to start with, then you can't go there. With respect to the 121, it's a motion for post-judgment, meaning that to start with, the court said, we find there was frivolity here, and therefore come to the court and tell me how much money you're owed.
Do you have authority for that?
No, I do not, because it was just raised and I do not have authority. So I'm not going to say I do.
Are you saying that in the pleadings, in the counterclaim, or in any papers, I'm not using the definition of pleading restrictively, but in no paper filed with the court prior to trial, did the defendants raise or cite Section 13,
17, 102? That's my recollection, Your Honor. It was after the fact. Not to my recollection in the pleading. I don't recall seeing it. Now, I could have overlooked it, but I don't think so. In fact, I just didn't see it. It was afterwards I went and looked at the pleadings to see if it had been raised and it hadn't been raised. And when I say pleadings, I'm talking about the complaint, answer, and so on. That's what I'm talking about. You know, there's one other factor that comes into play here. This is a little outside of the four corners, so to speak. But in this state, which this court is well aware, there are three possibilities for getting attorney's fees. One, of course, statutory. Now, that is the point. Second point, if you've got an agreement, the court said, there is no agreement. It went away. Lease went away. And third, there was no raising of this frivolity, if you will, of the claim. And I think that makes good sense, that what I say makes logical sense. This is not an ambush state. There are some that aren't, but this isn't one of them. If you don't tell me ahead of time what you're talking about, I can't defend to it. If they were going to raise that, which they didn't, and they would have put on evidence at the time of trial, which they didn't, to say this is frivolous, they didn't. Nothing happened.
Isn't it obvious that if you make a material allegation in a complaint, a critical allegation, namely that plaintiffs are assinees of Kickamoo Fitness, and you don't put on any evidence whatsoever at trial to support that allegation, that it is a groundless lawsuit? Isn't that just obvious common sense?
No, I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. In this particular case, the testimony didn't go far enough from Mr. Barchi. That's really what happened. I believed my client at the beginning when he told me what happened. I pleaded accordingly, and it didn't go far enough. In other words, I think, quite frankly, we had a breakdown in communication over that point. It wasn't that anybody was simply trying to sue to make troubles.
Is there testimony to that effect, affidavits or anything?
That.
To what you're saying? You're telling us what you told your client, which is...
No, what I'm saying is, at the time of trial, once my client was asked a question about the assignment, he wasn't able to answer it. He, in his mind, in my client's mind, I believe, he felt that he was doing the right thing, or was, you know, he was telling the truth. That's all I cared about. He told the truth. Now, as it happened, it didn't work out in his favor, but you know what? He told the truth. We didn't come in there and try to make something up. He told the court the way he felt, the way he understood it in his mind. That's the best we can do. I'm not gonna try to make up something. Sometimes it doesn't always work. It happens. I mean, I've been there before. It doesn't always work. It's not a precise type of thing. The fact is, this wasn't a frivolous lawsuit, and the trial court didn't find it was frivolous. Made no finding at all about frivolity. Now, the trial court is probably in the best position, I would think, in a case like this, to come up with, yes, it was frivolous, or no, it wasn't frivolous.
But we don't know why the trial court denied the motion for fees under 1317-102, do we? He didn't give any reasons.
He did not. He simply denied it. But you have to.
So don't we at a minimum have to remand for findings to figure out what the trial court in the first instance thought of that? I mean, we just don't know. We're guessing.
I think probably that the reason it was denied is it wasn't pled in the first place. It was not in the beginning. It wasn't the complaint. It wasn't in the answer. That's why I think the trial court said, look...
Let's assume you're wrong about that.
Okay.
And that it was, in fact, pleaded in a counterclaim or some other pleading.
Right.
Hypothetically, okay? Yeah. You said you didn't see it there, but let's assume it was. How would that change your argument?
Then the court should have made a finding. Had it been pled, the court should have made, if you plead something, the court's obligated. It should make a finding. But it wasn't pled. It simply, the counterclaim was not based on frivolity. That's why the court didn't make a finding, because there wasn't anything in front of the court to find about, to say yes, it was frivolous or no, it wasn't frivolous. Again, I go back to my argument. In this state, either you plead it, you live with it, or you don't plead it.
Right, but I asked you to assume that he had pleaded it.
Had he pleaded it, then the
court would... Do you then concede that we have to remand for findings?
If he had pleaded, and the court said, there's no frivolity here, yes, then I would say you have to remand for findings. But that's not what happened. We have to go by what happened here. And it wasn't pleaded, and it wasn't even raised in the counterclaim. Had ample opportunity to raise it on the counterclaim and didn't do so. That being said, I'll sit down. Unless you have further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bone, you have a little less than a minute.
Your Honors, I just want to address a couple of points. The first question was asked to Mr. Ginberg whether there was actually any evidence even offered at trial as to whether or not plaintiffs were assignees in support of the allegations that had been made by plaintiffs throughout the case. And the court, in ruling on my motion under Rule 50 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, said, in viewing all the evidence in the light most favorable to the Bartes and resolving every factual dispute in their favor, there has simply been no evidence presented that they were assigned any rights by Kikamu Fitness. The other thing I would point out to the court is that at various times throughout this litigation that spanned 5 years, I had mentioned specifically that plaintiffs were claiming to be assignees under this contract, and there's never been produced to me any assignment of rights by the plaintiffs or their counsel. And in my motion for summary judgment, where I just tried to dispose of this case at an early stage, in response to that, plaintiffs were still maintaining that they were assignees under the terms of the agreement. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. The court will issue an opinion in due course.